There's no solely French-speaking people here.
Est-ce qu'il y a des gens qui ne comprennent pas l'anglais?
Non, c'est bien.
Okay.
Okay. All right. So I just want to start with the idea that it's kind of a welcoming, or actually that it is welcoming for all of you to know that despite everything else that might have been happening in Montreal last night, we were here conspiring to really fight the existing threat to the whole world today. And that also could be soothing to know that tonight as well, we're going to pursue that even further with the presentation on how do we actually build the foundations to really now launch a renaissance. But nonetheless, I think all of us are here because we do have a certain understanding that, or of the insanity of the situation internationally. That kind of brings us all together today. Whether it's, I don't know, Dick Cheney in the White House, the Iraq War, the threats to Iran, the presently collapsing financial system, the insanity of the housing bubble, right, what we're seeing in the States with these biofuels and the push for ethanol, or even an example like we have here in Canada with the Canadian Wheat Board. And I'd like to start with that, actually, because this is, in a sense, what drove this research for me. A few weeks ago, a month ago, as we were really digging into what is happening to the Canadian Wheat Board. And during the research, in this document that we put out called the True...
True story behind the fall of the House of Windsor.
Yeah. Yeah, I think everyone should take a look at this. It's pretty well documented. In this report, actually, we came across this institution called the Royal Institution for International Affairs. And it happens to have certain off branches within many nations. In the States, it's the... what's it called? The
Council on Foreign Relations.
Yeah, thank you. Council on Foreign Relations. In Canada, it's the Canadian Institute for International Affairs. And so during that research, we ended up looking at the website to find out more about this institution, because what we're getting is that it's a forum for initiating discussion on international policy. And when we try to find out more about what this is all about, they don't really tell us anything on their website, but they did mention that they will be having an annual national meeting here in Montreal 1 month from now. Mm-hmm. So that was sort of the initiation for this whole project. And during the research, I came across a few things that really gave me a more profound understanding of what's actually happening today around the world. And so that's kind of the basis for what I'm going to go through today. And I think that it's important because, well, what you get in Pascal's class also is a certain understanding of the historical background of things. And I mean, this is absolutely important to have, because, you know, if you don't have any conception of the next 50 years or the next 100 years or how your actions today are actually going to affect the next 100 years, we could be stepping into a few problems 100 years from now. But a lot of this is actually coming out of a lack of understanding of what's been happening in the past, right? The past 100 years or the past 1,000 years or 5,000 years. And so I think it's almost nearly impossible to take part in any real fight for the future of humanity if you don't develop a certain emotional attachment to what's actually going on in the world right now. And to further that, I actually don't think that you can really do that unless you have a more profound understanding of the historical background of things. So that's leading into what we're going to look at now. And it's just interesting because you probably, for those that organize, get this on the streets all the time. Like, you're talking to young people about Dick Cheney and the threats to Iran or just to the world generally, and there's a lot of, like, well, I don't know, whatever, man, it's not my problem, or I can't, what do you want me to do, or yeah, Dick Cheney, or these types of comments where are actually quite dangerous because you're having a real lack of real drive to do anything within the general population of young people today. So, So I think that what we should start to do is get a sense of history by just traveling within our minds back 1,000 years, 3,000 years, 5,000 years, and looking at looking at the progression of humanity over the millenniums, right? So, and there's a lot that we've done. Well, can you just flip? You can, yeah, I mean, when you're thinking back to what Pascal was talking about, the ancient Greeks, just keep going. The school of Athens, the Pythagoreans, the Renaissance, a lot of great achievements that we've done in architecture, things that, that's the Brunelleschi's Dome. Michelle talked about that a little bit. So, anyways, you can look at that and just ponder those things for a moment. But also, I mean, we have as well, like you can't forget the establishment of the First Republic under Louis the 11th in France. That's actually Russia in below building in below unimaginable temperatures and still managing to come up with really wonderful architecture. That was the American Revolution, right? But it gives you a sense of what was needed at the time to unite a people to fight the threat. And the Civil War. It was also, yeah, so I mean, you could keep going, look at that. Yeah, some really great infrastructure projects. And there are a few of these things that you can think about. What was the state of the planet in that area before these projects were built? And a lot of the times you can have really swampy, unarable land. And yet after the project, you massive potential to cultivate and agriculture and things like that. The space program, we actually went to the moon. Is that the last one?
No. Well,
okay.
Sure.
Yeah. There you go. Oh yeah, nuclear power. I guess we're getting to where we are today. So this, you know, begs the question then, so what actually is history? And, or Schiller says, why and to what end do we study universal history? And what would, what do people think is the importance or purpose behind actually looking at some of this stuff more in depth? Does anyone ever think about that sometimes? Yeah?
Maybe by looking at history, we can come up with ideas for the future?
Yeah, sure.
It's always better to learn from other people's mistakes.
Yeah. And our own as well. But yeah. What were you going to say?
Just that the history sort of sets the context for the time. Now.
Yeah, sure.
All of our conclusions are a result of that.
Yeah. Okay, that's
yeah.
it. Mm-hmm.
There's a saying which goes, you know, like, if you don't know your history, then you're doomed to repeat
yeah.
the mistakes of the past. Mm-hmm. So I know we repeat that quote.
Yeah.
But
it's kind
yeah.
of funny, eh? Because the system is collapsing. Didn't it just go down in 1929? So. But it's also interesting to remember that if you're organizing campuses, young people generally, a lot of people don't really know why it collapsed. Maybe hence why it's collapsing again today, you know. So, what we can do is look at the development of all these things. Now, this is just to give you an idea, right? It's not in any way a full picture of the last 3,000 or 5,000 years. I wasn't really trying to do that, but I just wanted to get you guys thinking of that to begin a discussion on a continuous process, right? The development of history being this continuous process of, you know, certain philosophical ideas about truth, piety, belief in God, and most importantly, the nature of man itself. Because these were key ideas that have been continuously argued and fought over throughout history. So, you can see this actually. And we also know that history is composed with the rise and fall and rise again of empires. And so if you think of that going back to the first empires, anyone ever studied these? Maybe the first civilization? Yeah?
I read a bit about the Sumerians and Mesopotamia about the 2000 BC or something like that.
Babylonians? Okay, yeah. And I mean, this has happened over and over again. You've had the Roman Empire during the time of Jesus, right? Tons of them, actually. The Byzantine, the Venetian Empire, which we talked about last night. We had a class by Rob a few weeks ago that really goes into detail. These guys were probably the biggest financial empire ever to exist up until now. And the Ottomans, right? So, the British Empire, of course, that was also probably the biggest empire. So what is the idea that these guys adopt in order to, you know, or how are these guys thinking in order to have that mentality of imperialism? We know sort of what imperialist ideas are in terms of conquering the world. This idea of a minority of elitists to govern the many. And that's happened time and time again. But one thing that's interesting is that none of these empires can actually form and maintain their control over their population unless they actually insert within the population that they're controlling a certain conception that the population itself adopts concerning the nature of men. Right? Because if they were all given a classical humanist education, for example, about, you know, their true potential and their sovereignty and these types of things, no one would put up living under an empire. Right? So you can only maintain that empire if you actually destroy that conception within the population and replace it with something more bestial or something more lenient to the idea of an imperialism or an empire. So, but nonetheless, there have been factions that actually fought this, right? Like, that was the whole idea of the Renaissance. And just the idea of the classical humanist education itself is a complete contradiction to the idea of empire, because it's in the aim of developing the creative potentials of the human mind.
Sorry, can you repeat that?
Yeah, I said that there were factions that fought the idea of imperialism. The Renaissance is an example of that, and so is the a classical humanist education. Everything that embodies the idea of a classical humanist education is directly opposing the idea of empire, and actually is attacking it by developing within people the potential to be human. So yeah, so you've had this type of thing, right? That's actually risen throughout history to battle these ideas of imperialism. And I just want to give you one idea of that. There's been many, but to give you one idea or an example of that. Well, actually, I was just thinking to answer your question. What's your name?
Mary.
Okay. So I just thought of. Like a horse, right? Like, I grew up with horses, and it just made me realize that if a horse knew its true power, you know, like these big draft horses sometimes, like I was doing the horse and carriage at one point, huge, like, yeah. If they actually knew their true, what they're really capable of, there'd be no way at times that you'd be able to lead them through something they're deadly afraid of, you know? But so... So, or elephants, for example, you tie them to a chain, and they think they're tied up when really the elephant could just, you know. But that's the idea, though. So, you know, that this idea of empire would have to insert, kind of subvert, the population's understanding of what they're truly capable of, towards something that allows them to be suppressed. these different periods, like the Renaissance and the revival throughout history several times of the classical humanist education, has been in the aim of destroying this very idea of imperialism. And it's funny because if you're going to study history, you're going to see a continuous battle between the adoption of imperialism and then the destruction of it, and the adoption of again and destruction of it. And so then nonetheless, there were, of course, factions that rose to fight the Renaissance. And that's what I want to give you an example of. So in about 1527, a man by the name of Ignatius Loyola wrote a book titled The Book of the Spiritual Exercises. Has anyone heard of this or taken a look at it?
Yeah.
I don't know if you want to, but okay. So, but what it is, he's also the founder of the whole Jesuit movement, if you guys have heard of that. So, okay. Just to give you a brief idea, though, of this guy and this movement that he spun out of his ideas in this book, which are still regarded by psychologists today as a magnificent work because it has the power to really manipulate the mind the way that it does. But anyways, the idea was inner freedom in respect for temporal possessions. But what it really was a training in self-hypnosis. And the whole idea around this book and this movement initially was that progress is due to an ability to distinguish between right and wrong. But that the thing is that we're constantly in a battle between the two. So your insides are being torn, and then you're between Christ and Satan and ultimate extremes all the time, that you're just, in the end, you're just unable to choose. So you're actually become unable to know the difference between what is right and what's wrong. And what he's saying, actually, is that, and what critics of this guy tend to comment about his works, is that what you're doing is, through a series of exercises, you're going to experience heaven and hell so that your soul is infinitely imprinted and ingrained with the difference, so that you teach yourself the difference. And the way that they do this is through the use of images and just really intense sensory, like a provocation or whatever.
Stimulation?
Yeah, stimulation. So what they do, they're trying to enhance your sense perception through strong images of the ultimate battle between Christ and Satan, heaven and hell. And so the idea is to get you to, for example, see hell in your mind. There's 4 weeks of exercises. And the way that you awaken these senses, you're constantly like all your free thinking time is put towards like the images of seeing hell in your mind, smelling death, hearing torture, right? You taste the tears of, touch the fire burning, right? To really awaken all this, touch the fire burning your soul, like things like that, right? And so it's kind of twisted, right? But but the idea is you put a barrier on the mind, which actually inhibits you from any true knowledge of God or the Creator, and because that you would achieve through reason, right? But yet the exercises move you as far away from any use of reason as possible, and so you move away from ever potentially coming to know God or the Creator, because all of your ability to reason eventually becomes destroyed. And their key idea is really, how do you practice elaborate deception? Just to give you a sense, this movement that sprung out of the ideas that Ignatius Loyola was writing about in his book. They're called the Jesuits.
Mm-hmm.
So you know, some people have heard of these guys.
The Black Robe.
I don't know.
About the Jesuits coming to North America.
Okay. Yeah, they've managed to squirm their way into every part of the world pretty quickly.
They were extremely effective.
Yeah. Within 10 years, actually, they were dispersed around the entire globe, almost. So, they later became referred to as the Society of Jesus, and they were claiming to be Catholic. But what they actually did was they penetrated through, you can actually call them agents, they penetrated all other religions. So they weren't necessarily Catholic. And an example of that actually was that they were working with this guy, Calvinist. He was a Protestant, and this movement was aimed at the destruction of the Neoplatonists, which at the time were coming out of this Renaissance to revive the classical humanist education. And so the Society of Jesus and the Calvinist Protestants kind of, in a sense, fought together against this humanist, Neoplatonist faction that was coming out of the Renaissance. And so I'll just give you an idea of what this guy Calvinist was saying. Their philosophies...
Who's Calvin?
Calvin.
Yeah, sorry, Calvin. All right. So their ideas were pretty well the same. The only difference was that Loyola really stressed this idea of free will. So, okay, this isn't a speech, a famous manifesto addressed to the Emperor Charles V and the Princess of the Holy Roman Empire at the time. So Calvin accused the Catholics. Yeah, there was a little dispute, right, between the two, but they're essentially pretty well all in the same faction. So Calvin accused the Catholics of being able to understand how great, of being unable, sorry, to understand how great are the wounds which our human nature has borne since the fall. With us, they admit the existence of original sin, but minimize its importance by regarding the power of man as merely impaired and not totally destroyed. We, on the other hand, maintain that our nature is so corrupt that it is quite incapable of good. We convince man of his wretchedness and of his powerlessness, and thus bring him into a state of true humility, so that he is deprived of all confidence in his own powers and puts his trust in God alone. So maybe they're a little bit more intense, but they're pretty well together on this. What Loyola and the Jesuits were saying, it's an interesting philosophy. It kind of reminds me, well, what they were saying was the ends will justify the means. And so if you can find, in a sense, if you sin, but you can justify it, then it's not really a sin. For example, if you're going duck hunting and you miss and hit your friend, then it's not really your fault. Because you didn't mean to hit your friend. That's the philosophy, right? So, basically it was a denial of man's ability to reason to make moral decisions. And so since which actually is a complete, it's a completely contradictory to the entire New Testament and what Christ was preaching. But nonetheless, what they're saying is that since you have no real ability to reason, then you have no responsibility to. So what they did, you know, since then you started having all kinds of weird things going on, weird behaviors, right? Because people didn't really, people didn't really think through things, and if you did something bad, it didn't really matter. So what they did then was they said, well, all you got to do is confess. So these guys are the ones that brought in this whole idea of frequent confessions to basically just kind of relieve yourself of all, you know, all the bad things that you do, which aren't really your fault and all that. But now the interesting thing of the Jesuits, which were coming right out of this Venetian faction, which are the master spies of the pre-Renaissance, what they carried on in that legacy was, well, that very idea of kind of scheming their way and spying on the population. And I'll give you a sense how they did that was very quickly now becoming all the confessors of the rich aristocracy.
Mm-hmm.
So everyone's come to tell them all their sins. And they quickly became the most advanced intelligence faction. But just to expand on their character, though, they were also largely responsible for the religious manipulation leading up to the 30 Years' War. And they were also doing things like they once marched into Bohemia, burnt all the books. Like, they would tear down libraries. They were pretty savage. So, anyways, there's a lot, like, you can say about these guys, the Jesuits. But what I just really wanted to give an example of basically an attempt to introduce within the population a certain bestiality and a certain concept about the nature of man, which is completely degrading in the eyes of a humanist or someone that's living in the tradition of the Neoplatonists.
Yeah, I was just going to say about the Jesuits, they also went to a lot of countries and started up schools for the young. In fact, the University I go to, Concordia, has a Loyola campus.
Yeah.
Named after him.
Yeah.
You can imagine, they've also corrupted the education of the young.
Yeah, be careful.
Loyola.
There's also, yeah, there's all kinds of campuses named after these people. But so that's an example of how, you know, to what extent people will go to, in a sense, set the conditions in the population to allow for a new wave of imperialism. So, yeah, so what we're seeing then is time and time again, these fundamental questions regarding the nature of man are coming up to the surface and being argued and fought out. All right. This idea of imago vivi Dei, man in the living image of God, the creator, versus the idea that man is a beast needing to be tamed. Right? And better tame it, because it'll just, you know, if you let this animal go loose, it'll just kind of follow its savage instincts and war will perpetuate. Yeah, sure.
Can you repeat the question?
Yeah, sure. So,
What, just so other people know what he was asking?
Yeah. He's asking, what does it mean to be in the living image of God? Right? Okay. Yeah, well, that's one of those fundamental questions that have been brought up time and time again, right? Is man an animal, or is there something more to being human? And so these are kind of the two ideas that are at the root of this whole thing. At the root of imperialism, where man would be just an animal, and therefore you would need a minority to govern, or in the light of the other idea, where all men are created equal, expressing a certain potential of creativity, which is a reflection of the principle of creativity in the Creator. So you can think of it as the living image of God expressing a potential to do good and discover. If God is the Creator, expressing a principle of creativity, then in the living image of that Creator would signify that you are also driven by that principle as well. So then that man expresses the principle of creativity, which allows him to make discoveries and breakthroughs like we have in science, technology, in the aim and purpose of increasing the quality of life for all mankind to come.
Yeah, I just think it's kind of important to note too that a lot of the Platonic, there's these Platonic Christians at the time, you'd see their conception of God was really one of God as an architect, in a sense, like existing within the universe as an always with a compass or as an architect, the creative force. And if you have it within your belief system to see yourself as an image of a creative force within that operates within the universe as such a creative force, it puts a new responsibility on yourself and a new motivation to actually be that image of what you see. You know, if you're going to be in the image of an architect, you yourself will actually be inclined to creativity and to create as such, you know? As well. Just interesting idea.
Yeah, you can also think of it like, how do ants or any animal really lives? You don't really see a certain, you know, all of a sudden a massive breakthrough in the way that they'll run their little societies. Like, ants have been building the same houses for thousands of years. Maybe that's not the best example, but that there's a fundamental difference between mankind and any other animal, where mankind can actually make these breakthroughs that will allow for an increase in potential to discover more. And that is in the likeness of a creator because it expresses the principle of creation. Actually, Lynn wrote a paper called What is God That Man Is in His Image? So you can read that. But I'll read you a part of it because it kind of goes through. Maybe he can make it clearer. So he says, In addressing the first chapter of Genesis, Philo of Alexandria, a friend of the Christian apostle Peter, in their common struggle against the Gnostic Simon, the magician, focused their attention on the meaning of verses 26 to 30, upon the notion of the individual person as made in the image of God. This is not the bodily image, but the image of the individual human intellect's creative potentials, which, with emphasis upon the term creative. The crucial feature of Philo's case is readily mastered from the vantage point of Plato's Socratic method. Each person is given the intellectual potential which no animal has, the power not only to imagine states of nature which have never before existed in the universe, but, under certain restrictions, to impose those ideas efficiently upon the universe generally. The condition to accomplish this is that that imagination is brought into accord with universal lawfulness. It is creativity so defined, which represents the individual person's intellect cast in the image of God's efficiently creative intellect. By this means, one is enabled to recognize among one's own efficient forms of intellectual states a quality which is a reflected image of God. This argument was adopted by Plato, who defines what Philo later described as human creativity as composed of four successively higher states of intellect. These four states are named by him hypothesis, higher hypothesis, hypothesizing the higher hypothesis, and the knowledge of the certainty of the efficient existence of the unhypothesized good, or God. Using modern language, Plato's dialectic is summed up as follows. For those familiar with the author's original discoveries in science, this may be seen as old ground revisited. For those not familiar with that, it is essential that it is reproduced once again here. And then he goes into a little bit more of this idea of hypothesis. So that's that kind of gets at your question. It is interesting that this idea of hypothesis, creativity, actually is something that no other animal can do. And we're studying this pretty rigorously by looking at Kepler's discoveries of universal gravitation. But you can also just think back to what you were talking about, electricity. You know, the light bulb, for example, or, you know, the first heat-powered machinery. So things like that would never have occurred if we didn't express that principle. So what we're looking at when we're looking at all of history is really the process of man's total relationship to the universe as it has developed over time. So, and Lynn, in this paper, The Wells of Doom, which is also pretty good, he says a few things about history, which can help us get to the bottom of what this really is and why this is important. He says, the distinctive ecological, if you will, relationship of man to the universe is man's increasing power as a species over that universe. This power is located in the manner in which the properly developed sovereign innate cognitive potentials of the human individual mind, human individual's mind, discovered new valid principles of the universe, both physical principles and the principles which govern this remarkable subjective potential of the individual human cognitive processes themselves. In short, history is a history of orderable sequences of discovery and practice of ideas in Plato's specific anti-empiricist sense of idea. So that was Lynn. But now if you're an empiricist, you might have a different conception of what history is, or even a different way of how to look at history. Because if you're looking at it in the sense what we just looked at, this battle over the rise and fall of empires, in the eyes of an actual empiricist, could appear something more like the battle to maintain the empire throughout the course of history over this idea of the sovereign nation state that tends to try to flourish every now and then. Right, so, and actually if you're an empiricist, probably then your biggest threat would be just that. Right, that somewhere a sovereign nation state might rise and potentially even to influence other parts of the world to fight for independence as well. Nation state being governing in the general interest of the people, the general welfare. So throughout history we have this type of a battle over these two very contradicting ideas of the nature of man. And that, to a large extent, is how you can look at history as an unfolding battle over, you know, which conception of man is going to prevail. Which conception of man do we want to be the idea that, to be the dominant idea on this planet today and for the future? So in that sense, when you think about today, and you think about what is really going on today, and do people know? Do people get a sense of, are people often confused about that? Overwhelmed at times, maybe?
I saw, recently watched an interview of George Bush on 60 Minutes. Yeah. And you just, I mean, I'm just like, at the end of the show, just like, absolutely dumbfounded as to the scope of what's wrong here.
Yeah.
I don't know how to describe it. It's good to be here because I think that you guys are working on ways to describe what's actually happening. I think it's important because how does a person who has such a low intellectual capacity running the most important country in the world? You know, and when he's talking, he actually believes what he says, which is another thing, which means that he's super insulated. You know, it's a huge, it's just a, it's a wild puzzle. And, it's nice that working on unraveling that, because, yeah, dumbfounded, overwhelmed, definitely.
Yeah, you guys ever notice that this is like, if you look at history, and then you look at today, you notice that this is a really kind of a fast-paced, quickly changing world. And we are, all of us in this room, living under the idea of globalization. And it's important to get a sense of what that means, right? And what is really behind that whole idea, the era of globalization, because our generation is faced with that, right? And so that's what I want to talk about a little bit right now. Because it's an interesting, a year ago, published this animation of an example, right? Take the U.S., the whole country, and you map manufacturing, 50 years ago, and you look at the process of how it actually deteriorated to like less than half today. And we've done that for nuclear power, infrastructure, water dams, all kinds of things, right? And it's astonishing. So, what the hell's really going on? This whole idea of outsourcing, you guys heard of that?
Mm-hmm.
Outsourcing our jobs for cheap labor, man. Get the program. What are they teaching? I hear a lot about this out of a lot of students who are really convinced that you just have to get competitive in the global market, right? And so, but this, it's just strange because, not only are you keeping, for example, your factory of like Chinese workers, for example, right? Poor at like $2 an hour or $2 a day or whatever. But you're actually losing all of our productive jobs in our first world nations also. Right? And that a good example is what was happening with GM or Delphi, right? We're lobbying Congress with a lot of people from Delphi once or twice a few months ago, because this is like a microcosm of what's happening all across North America. But these guys are like not just pissed off, but like almost panic stricken in a sense, because they're going from like $27 an hour jobs to like $9.50 an hour, or completely losing their jobs altogether. Having to find, and let's say you're a worker with a family, a mortgage, and a car, right? And now you have to take on two other extra part-time jobs, flipping burgers and cutting hair or whatever. No productive labor because it's all overseas, right? So, yeah, that's one thing. But when you look at it on a national level, all our productive, skilled labor force leaving the country, who's going to build the nation? We constantly need to be reinvesting into our infrastructure and things like that. So who's going to do that? Right, how much you guys get a sense of this idea of what the, like, just to stay on that outsourcing thought for a moment. But it's also important to get a sense that this whole idea actually restricts the potential for mankind to develop, in a sense, because it's lowering your potential to produce. And an example of that would be, a simple example of that would be, take one worker here, one steel worker, or one worker, one machine here in North America, and you get him out of there, he can go cut hair and flip burgers. You replace him in Asia with 10 Chinese. So you get the sense, though, that if you were to actually give the opportunity of people in Asia and Africa to develop, how much we can actually how much we can actually get done looking at humanity as a whole, in a sense. Like, if you were to give every one of those Chinese one machine, right? Or everyone in Africa the opportunity to do what one person here can do. So by this, by following this whole idea of outsourcing, you're actually lowering and restricting the potential of the entire planet to advance. Now, the other thing that's interesting, the other thing is that what we are seeing everywhere is the entertainment life, right? So bands and video games, and I don't really have to do this because you guys all just live right in it. But yeah, just keep going. Well, yeah, everyone remembers, man. This is like the example of the role. Kiss. You guys know Kiss, right? Come on. You guys know Kiss, right? But look, wait a minute. That's an example. Wait, go back for a minute. This is fashion. I'm sorry, but they're not real punks. Like, this is like to be cool. Yeah. They don't live on the streets. They're not real punks. This is, yeah. So anyways, this is going to give you an idea. This is cool today. Cool. Yeah.
Whoa.
I just figured I was going to be extreme for a moment. But this is nightlife every night in Montreal. So I think we've all witnessed. Oh, why not, man? These are our role models now. Better save up. But they're cool too.
Whoa.
Yeah, this is what we see as a result often.
Where is that picture taken?
I don't know, but this is. Anyone recognize this?
Yeah, that's me.
Yo, one thing though is, look at him. Doesn't he look kind of innocent and pure? Look where he's going, though.
He's the only one looking at the screen. Maybe.
Yeah, but you know where he's going, poor kid.
Let's bring a tear to my eye.
Yeah, this is where Matt. Where Matt has to work often. Okay, go back. So. Yeah, so okay, so the bread and circus civilization of ancient Rome. It's kind of present in its modern form. That's one side. What about you guys, major corporations? The era of major corporations taking over all sectors of the economy necessary to necessary for the advancement of human life. Yeah, you could check out that next
book.
Yeah, to give you an example. I don't know how many people kind of looked at that. It's a little bit small, but this is just a small example of, have you guys ever heard of the Club of the Isles? Probably not. So, but what they do is, it's a minority of corporations that have their grip on all the vital sectors of the economy. So, for example, food, you'll have a cartel of companies that have their grip and basically make insignificant all other food companies. Right? We call it a cartel because they're very
worldwide. Or?
These sectors, like let's say food, banking, mining. You something missed out there, but I had oil in there.
It's there.
Yeah.
Oh. Okay, alright, so, anyways, but food, oil, mining and minerals, industrial, your industries, right? like steel industries. An example, a good example, is Dofasco. We had in Canada the number one top quality steel producers of the world, which was a Canadian company. And that got bought up in this fight, in this grab for all natural, or for all vital sectors.
What was the name of the company?
It was called Dofasco. Mittal took it over. Mittal is like the biggest steel company on the planet. What these guys are doing is they'll go and they'll target certain companies that are pretty big and try to take them over, so they keep growing as a power. This is why the Canadian Wheat Board's being dismantled, because it's a pretty significant body that produces and exports all types of grains and food, things like that. So, yeah.
So when you say, there's a list of banking companies that say.
These are the biggest ones.
Now, they...
I might be missing
a few. They control all other banks, like Bank of Montreal, Royal Bank.
Well, they have a significant pull on other...
So they have the market share, these companies?
Yeah, yeah. Well, for example, oil, that's almost a monopoly, you could say. Like, these, the Six Sisters.
Six Sisters?
Yeah, they're six companies. Two of them are British, British Petroleum and Royal Dutch Shell. They control a little, pretty well over more than half of the oil that is under the wing of these Six Sisters. Call them the Six Sisters. The other four companies are American. Yeah, and I mean, it's like...
It doesn't surprise me in an industry like oil so much.
Well, yeah.
Because the idea of a small company in oil doesn't make sense to me at this point. So it doesn't surprise me. But like with banking or with food, like for instance, you mean everything on the shelves that say Loblaws is controlled by those... somehow gets there.
The grains and
four?
Things like that that other third world nations might want to sell, they have to sell to these companies or they starve.
Something like 90% is controlled by four companies, I think. Is that right? Those four control 73% of the... It's the grain trade, so they're the transportation. Like that's kind of where they dominate. So they might not... They're sometimes involved in processing, like Cargill that does that. ADM is into the ethanol production, but those four control 73% of the world grain trade. And the fifth, which I can't remember which one it is, but the top five control over 80%. So that's it's the idea to have hegemonic cartels in each of these sectors. And that's the thing about banking. They're the top 5 to 10 banks probably dwarf all the banks combined.
Yeah. It's like you look at the minerals and metals section. These guys are controlling all vital metals that are necessary for economic life, building anything from machines to refrigerators. Once you refine them, machine tools, things like that, right? The metals, the material that you need to build these things are under the hands of a very small minority of people. And it's like that for the industrial sector. Also, infrastructure. You have companies that will go up and buy or privatize certain vital infrastructure. And then a lot of the times they can put a toll on it. Things like that. Like highways, and then put a toll. Or water infrastructure. And things that are pretty crucial is... These guys generally go after. And the interesting thing, once you start to look into the board of directors of these companies, a lot of, yeah, a lot of the times they're all intertwined. Hence the club, yeah? The Club of the Isles. So it's a minority of very wealthy and powerful elites, although I hate to call them that. But media, I just put those there. One that I switched up. But anyways, for Canada, you have, like, Quebecor and Glacier's Venture together control a really significant amount of all our news channels, newspapers, magazines, radio stations, TV stations, everything. But that's just Canada. Well, actually, to give you an example of the magnitude of how this is actually has an impact, during the research that Rob was doing on the wheat board, he came across this article written by a lady named Wendy Holmes out west, and she had an editorial for a newspaper, a smaller newspaper, that she was apparently writing in. Every 2 weeks she had a column for 12 years. And maybe a month or two ago.
Is it in the middle of the summer?
Okay, a few months ago, she ends up writing an article on the wheat board. And to really expose what's going on, you know, she's not blind. And apparently the next day, she got a call from the Governor General and the director, chief executive of Glacier Ventures International, that Ultra Corp. I didn't put it on there, sorry. But that...
The media company?
Yeah. Yeah, for that controls a lot of the media out west in Canada. And so she got a call the next day by those two chief executive, you know, and that was it, and she was out. But you imagine, though, that the call from Glacier Ventures International, that's way at the top of the line. She wasn't even directly working for them. She was working for her newspaper that is higher up the line, owned by this company, who found out about the article and decided that is not going to happen. And I think that there's a little twist to that, right? Isn't he also on the board of Archer Daniels Midland?
Well, the one of the directors of
the food cartel
is the CEO of a company called Agricor United, which is the biggest grain handler in Canada.
Oh yeah.
And they would be the primary beneficiaries of seeing this farmer cooperative dismantled. Mm-hmm. But Agricor itself is owned by Archer Daniels Midland, so.
So obviously they didn't want any articles going in the newspaper about how the wheat board's getting screwed over.
Yeah. And then the other thing was, Brian Mulroney sits on the board of Archer Daniels Midland, but he's also the chairman of the board of Quebecor, and Quebecor was also running attacks against the wheat board out west as well. So you have this kind of, a lot of people are in bed with each other.
Yeah, all right, so just to give you a sense, we can look at the media thing for a moment. BBC you guys all know BBC, right? British Broadcasting
Corporation.
You all know it.
You all know it.
Anyways, these guys are probably the biggest. 24 hours a day, English and 40 other languages. Apparently many countries, it's their only source of news. So that's kind of rough. And you can look at the key personnel of these corporations and note that he's a CEO or something, I forget. But on the board as key personnel, this guy is a trustee of the Rhodes Trust Fund. So we can talk about that in a minute. But, yeah, you have, and then the next guy is a member of the RIIA.
Royal Institute.
Royal Institute for International Affairs, which we can get into more in a minute. But the key idea, you can go with the next one, right? Reuters News Agency, another ultra media company. These guys are the largest news wire service in the world, 19 languages, 198 branch offices within 86 countries, over 4,000 intelligence officers deployed in 149 countries. They're the world's largest international television news agency, and they reach about a half a billion households in over 80 different countries. So you get a sense of the power that these guys have over the information that people are receiving. And the interesting thing to look at is the key, like, who's running this stuff, the key personnel. So I have a few of them there, but of course, like, the lists are a bit bigger, you know, and they're changing, but they're all along the same type of slime mold. So, go back for a minute. I don't know if you guys, Conrad Black, he's a member of the Canadian Privy Council Trilateral Commission. He sits on one of the major banks we saw, the CIBC. He's also part of the Bilderberg Society. Richard Perles is also a key guy in this Hollinger media company. So he was for the American Enterprise Institute. And you always have, Margaret Thatcher. So the last British Prime Minister, if anyone knows anything about her. So anyways, Dwayne Andreas, who is the chairman of Archer Daniels Midland, which...
Is Thatcher dead?
I don't know.
Really?
Is
she ever alive?
Yeah.
But Dwayne Andreas, I mean, he is. See, this is another guy. He's the chairman of Archer Daniels Midland, which is one of the major companies in the grain cartel. So, and Zbigniew Brzezinski. Right, so these guys are all on the board of these ultra media companies. So. Yeah, okay, sorry, can you go back for a moment? Yeah, Hollinger, that's just the last one I wanted to mention, because this one's in Canada, and this is pretty important. This is the one I was kind of giving the description of the people on this board, This company was bought with Rothschild Money Banking. With Rothschild Money Banking, they started purchasing all kinds of telegraphs, different newspapers, ultra newspapers like the Spectre, which is a British establishment journal, and also they have 98.9% of Jerusalem Post, which is pretty right wing. But the thing is, this company owns about 80 daily newspapers and 300 weekly newspapers in the United States. And I was just reading you, because I kind of missed, but I was just reading you the board of directors of Conrad Black and Richard Pearl Thatcher, the chairman of Archer Daniels Midland, and Zbigniew Brzezinski as a small list. Yeah?
I was just going to say, a lot of newscasts, because I watch the news a lot on different channels, and often they use Reuters as the source of the story.
Mm.
So it's not only Reuters and their subsidiary companies and corporations, it's also other people picking up their stories constantly, whether it's even sometimes on Yahoo News or Google News or whatever.
Right.
The stories are picked up from Reddit news agencies.
Yeah, that's a good point. Right.
Associated Press is another domain.
Huh?
Associated Press.
What do you mean?
Another one that you see a lot of.
Your articles always come from the same, like, try and find something that comes out of Montreal.
Oh, articles come from Associated Press.
Yeah.
There's syndication
companies. Yeah, because that, I mean, Reuters is primarily controlled by the people that were also on the chairman of the Bank of England, and different associations like the Trilateral Commission, things like that, Kissinger Associates. And that's, so I just want to give you a sense of that. That's kind of a pretty intense.
The other big one in Canada is Quebecor.
Connecticut
and Hollinger are the two big ones for Canada.
You've also got Asper family. You've got the Thompson. The Thompson family has a lot of, like, Rogers. They have the Rogers networks and stuff like that. You've also got Canada's Global. Those are probably the biggest ones. I think there's only nine companies, media companies in all of Canada. Control everything. And some of them are really tiny.
The thing is, when you're looking at this, this is the key personnel of Hollinger, and what you're looking at is a company that is placed in Canada as a puppet of something that is dominated by the British. Everyone on that list. So, okay. Now, that's interesting. It's the same thing for the other two. What the hell? So you have, in a sense, the people internationally are being fed whatever this faction of people chooses. And then at the same time, so, you know, the well-being or the information within your population, if you're, let's say, the government of your nation, it's totally out of your control because they're receiving all of this information that you don't have any control over as a government of your nation, for example. Like that, and you know, all your home manufacturing are leaving the country. Your infrastructure is depleting because in the last 30 years we haven't really been investing much into any of this. This is why in the States you see things like Katrina, right? And we have no one really developing the skills to rebuild any of this because people are, the productive jobs are moving overseas, so the people are bread-fed this whole post-industrial service economy stuff, moving into the service sector. And it's, I mean, it's an interesting thing to think at this point about what it is that allows for the sovereignty of a nation. Do you guys ever think, anyone have any ideas about that? Like what it is that actually will make a nation sovereign?
Well, actually, to me, the most important thing is the economic capacity, the industrial capacity. Because if you can't produce for yourself, then how sovereign are you?
You
buy from other countries and you need everything that you use comes from another country. It's not very sovereign, especially if the other country doesn't want to sell it to you.
Yeah. Then isn't it kind of insane that we don't have any, for example, our steel industries. We don't really own any of them anymore. So how do you build anything? the tractor for you to build your rail, right? What other economic capacity would you need, right? Or water plants. How are you going to build any of those if you don't have, for even a steel industry is one example, right? So, now this is what these guys are really doing, is taking the sovereignty of nations out of the hands of governments and making the governments completely dependent upon these corporations to provide for the people. So the sovereignty of the nations is now being placed more and more all the time within the hands of these big-time corporations that are all interlinked, that also have the media, you know, within this club that we call the Club of the Isles. Are we the ones that call it the Club of the Isles, or is that their actual name?
No, they actually call themselves, because it's the British Isles, and all of the different territories and then countries that were acquired by the Brits.
Hmm.
So as they accumulated each of these entities, many of which were islands or had islands off the coast of big countries like China, Macau, this type of thing. They were called the Lords of the Isles because they were ruled by different dukes or lords and stuff like that. And then they all joined the club. And I don't think any of us here could join the club.
I think was it French Isles under the 7th?
And I don't know who it is now. I would think it's Prince Philip, but I don't know. I don't know. Edward the 7th, I guess, died in the 30s.
So that's... So that's what's happening. Now everyone has a sense of it. Now, is it a coincidence? Right, is this just the turn of the century that we just gotta abide by? You know, the trend. So, yeah, how can we actually know? And now, how do we actually know whether or not there's an actual intention behind all this? You know, or if it's just the big guy eating the smaller guy for his own power seeking pleasure or whatever. Well, that necessitates an investigation to a fellow by the name of Cecil Rhodes, about 100 or a little bit more, 1870s, over a century ago. This guy, have you guys ever heard of him?
Mm-hmm. Rhodes Scholar?
Royal Rhodes mm-hmm. College or yeah. University?
Yeah.
Rhode Island?
Not the same.
He's a South African gold and diamonds magnate. He was director of De Beers. You guys know about that company, right? So, this guy studied at Oxford University in the 1870s. And where he was inspired by a fellow by the name of Lord John Ruskin, who was giving these lectures at the university. And I think this is important because I have a quote of Ruskin to give you an idea of who he was. And keep in mind that Rhodes was actually found dead with his a copy, a written copy of the speech in his pocket that he carried around all the time. So to give you a sense of who he was, that's Ruskin. I'll just give you a sense of who Rhodes was.
Who's this guy?
I'm going to tell you a little bit about his inspirer, Lord John Ruskin. Yeah. So, all right, so this was, I don't know what a Slade professor is. He was an arts professor, maybe that's some... Yeah, he was he gave a lecture as Slade Professor of Arts at Oxford. This is a transcript. This is a section of that letter, which Rhodes carried around in his pocket. A destiny is now possible to us, the highest ever set before a nation to be accepted or refused. Will you, youths of England, make your country again a royal throne of kings? A sceptred's isle? For all the world, a source of light? A center of peace? This is what England must do or perish. She must found colonies as far and as fast and as far as she is able, formed of the most energetic and worthiest men, seizing any piece of fruitful waste ground, a fruitful waste ground she can set her foot on, and then teaching her colonists that their chief virtue is to be fidelity to their country, and that their first aim is to be to advance the power of England by land and sea. So, he was definitely an empiricist. So that's, to give you a sense of that. It's also interesting to trace back these characters. He claims to be a social Darwinist, John Ruskin, right, which... the study of eugenics, I guess, to make this survival of the fittest, but really it's an elite race, right? And Darwin actually mentions in his autobiography that he is a he was directly influenced by Thomas Malthus, who taught on overpopulation because mankind was unable to progress, and so you have to reduce the population. Right, so that's Ruskin, and just as a side note here, he was a protege of this guy, Bulwer Lytton, Lytton. And this guy brought back this branch of Rosicrucians, which was a Freemasonic branch around the time of Lord Palmerston. It was along the lines of the Hermetic Order of the Golden Dawn, if anyone knows about that. Hermes. He's the symbol of that section or branch of Masons, and he's the god of partying and just
Isn't he the Hermes? Yeah, he's messenger. He's Mercury.
Then who's
Dionysus?
No. Where's Rob? the golden boy. You know what I mean? On the top
Apollo.
Of the.
That's Hermes.
Hey, Hermes. Isn't he the Okay, well, anyways, Lord Bulwer Lytton, who was the teacher of Ruskin, is responsible for working with Lord Palmerston around the time to bring back the Scottish Rite Freemasonry into England. So it just gives you a sense of what these guys were up to. They also talk a lot about people that influenced them in the past imperialists. So with that in mind, as a background, I just want to give you guys a sense of Cecil himself. Now, so this is a piece that he wrote called Confessions of Faith in 1877 that you guys can all check out. It's pretty, it's short, so it's worth getting a sense of what he was saying. I'll just quote a few parts. I contend that we are the finest race in the world, and that the more of the world we inhabit, the better it is for the human race. The absorption of the greater portion of the world under our rule simply means the end of all wars. At this moment, had we not lost the America, I believe we could have stopped the Russian-Turkish war by merely refusing money and supplies. Having these ideas, what scheme could we think of to forward this object? Africa is still lying ready for us. It is our duty to take it. It is our duty to seize every opportunity of acquiring more territory, and we should keep this one idea steadily before our eyes, that more territory simply means more of the Anglo-Saxon race, more of the best, most human, most honorable race the world possesses. To forward such a scheme, what a splendid help a secret society would be. A society not openly acknowledged, but who would work in secret for such an object. Let us form the same kind of society, a church for the extension of the British Empire. A society which would have members in every part of the British Empire working with one object and one idea. We should have its members placed at our universities and our schools, and we should watch the English youth passing through their hands. Just one, perhaps in every thousand, would have the mind and feeling for such an object. He should be tried in every way. He should be tested, whether he is endurant, possessed of eloquence, disregardful of the petty details of life, and if found to be such, then elected and bound by oath to serve for the rest of his life in his country. He should then be supported, if without means, by the society and sent to that part of the empire where it was felt he was needed.
Pretty clear.
I think that's what he calls the when you bring that up, but there was a special my history class. They called it the burden of the
white man.
Burden.
Yeah, he studied that as well. Right? Mm-hmm. That's part of the genders as well.
Yeah.
Yeah,
it's civilizing
the other races, even if
you're Christian. Yeah, that's right.
Mm.
Yeah. So just to finish off a few things here that he says, after that you won't need to read it. The society should inspire and even own portions of the press, for the press rules the mind of the people. The society should always be searching for members who might by their position in the world, by their energies or character, forward the object. But the ballot and test for admittances should be severe.
Sever.
Whatever. All right. For fear that death might cut me off before the time of attempting its development, I leave my worldly goods in trust to S.H. Shippard and the secretary of the colonies at the time of my death to try to form such a secret society with this object. Yeah. Je t'entends pas. Well, ça, ça se fait une autre classe. Mais il y en a beaucoup à dire sur ce sujet. Par contre, ça a l'air que... Well, the... Sorry. What I'm finding is that a lot of the inspiration, or the inspirational characters, actually came from these networks. But, we'll go through that in another class when I figure out more about this whole thing. He's asking about the Masons. Is this the same thing? So I'd say that I don't really want to comment on that right now because I don't know. But I can tell you that pretty well all of these people were Masons. That's what I do know.
So was George Washington, right?
So that's a whole other, really a whole other discussion.
Really, what it always comes down to, though, is that outlook that Aristotelian and Aristotle and Plato, it really comes down to your outlook of your conception of man's relationship to God as as a creative being or image of a creator or animal, and what God's purposes or what your idea of God is. If it's a mystic idea, if like God has been very much mystified in our culture through the way we see the universe as being something that can't really be known by man's mind. And when you start looking into the roots of Aristotelianism and the mysticism that it opens the doors to, you've had these, like remember she was talking about, there was like the Neoplatonic movements that were really inspirational for the Renaissance. Well, there's roots that go back to, it's not something you can just delegate to one single sort of clump, either. Like
yeah,
Masons
listen.
Are just that.
Whatever, listen. Benjamin Franklin, right? He was a Mason, but he was also one of the greatest spies ever. So you don't know really why he was a Mason. Maybe I might have to become a Mason. You know? Whatever, like, you get a sense, like, that it's a very complicated subject, but I think that from what I get a sense of is that maybe this was necessary. He spent a lot of time very close to the enemy before he fought the revolution. So he really got to know it from the inside. And a lot of these, a lot of these really great revolutionary figures had to become good spies in order to do what they did. And so then a lot of them actually, you can trace their background into certain things like that. But just, I thought this was interesting. Now, so Rhodes, he wrote 7 wills. And, all of them have new additions of trustees who he's going to leave the fund to carry out the mission. And so in about 13 years later, after he wrote the piece of Confessions of Faith, he writes to one of his trustees on the third will, giving directions. A letter giving directions of how to go about forming this thing. And he says, in considering questions suggested, take the constitution of the Jesuits, if obtainable, and assert English empire for Roman Catholic religion. So it's really in that legacy of how to go about spreading this slime mold that, in the legacy of the Jesuits, that these guys were going to carry this thing out. So, I wanted to read you an excerpt of his first will, which the seven of them after that, the five of them after that are pretty well the same, and the last two are interestingly different, where they don't mention anything about a secret society. But, so the first five are very much along the lines of this right here. Secret society voted to, okay, quote, "The extension of British rule throughout the world, the colonization by British subjects of lands where the means of livelihood are attainable by energy, labor, and enterprise, and especially the occupation by British settlers of the entire continent of Africa, the Holy Land, the valley of the Euphrates, the islands of Cyprus and Candia, the whole of South America, the islands of the Pacific, not hitherfore possessed by Great Britain, the whole of the Malay Archipelago, the seaboard of China and Japan, and most importantly, the ultimate recovery of the United States of America as an integral part of the British Empire." So he didn't...
What did that leave?
Huh?
What does that leave?
Greenland. So he obviously didn't do this alone. There were several helpers that were involved in the whole thing. One of them is a fellow by the name of W.T. Steed, William Steed, S-T-E-A-D. No, that's Bulwer. Bulwer is old, long ago. You can tell he's crazy. Go next.
Steed.
I think I have another picture.
Extraterrestrial.
I have another one of him, though?
Yeah,
that's him, too, in his younger days. Okay. So, so this guy is pretty important because he was actually directly given the... It was him that he was given the mission to take on this idea of carrying out a society that would be modeled on the Jesuits. So he wrote a letter. Rhodes wrote a letter to Steed in 1981. So you can get a sense of how they were collaborating on this.
Rhodes, 1881.
Yeah, 1891.
1891.
Yeah.
Oh, you said 1981.
Oh. Sorry. Okay.
We'll play with 3,000
years. 1891, yeah. I do that sometimes. So, okay. So, all right. So he says, "Please remember the key of my idea discussed with you is a society, copied from the Jesuits as to organization, the practical solution of a differential rate tariff. That the work with America in the forefront is devising tariffs to boycott your manufacturers, and that this is the supreme question, for I believe that England, with fair play, should manufacture for the world. And being a fair trader, I believe, until the world comes to its senses, you should declare war. I mean a commercial war with those who are trying to boycott your manufacturers. You might finish the war by union with America and universal peace. I mean only after 100 years or so.
Hmm.
Well.
Okay. So yeah. This whole thing, yeah, so they use different instruments, right? He had key people that were helping him to carry this thing out, and they used different things, like this whole idea of the commercial war that he's talking about, and of this idea of propaganda, is probably at the forefront of their tools, that Rhodes was advocating to be used on the population. And actually, Steed, who was editor at the time of this Pall Mall Gazette in Britain, he actually spent, like, I don't know how many years, but he spent quite some time in jail in 85 for publishing articles on organized vice. So when he came out, Rhodes contacted him pretty well straight up to get him involved in the whole mission. And so this is the response that Steed writes to his wife after first meeting Rhodes and after their first discussion together on this whole thing. Okay, sorry, so this is in 1894 now. Steed discusses with Rhodes. This one here is Rhodes this is something that Rhodes is replying to the discussion that Steed is replying to the discussion that he had with Rhodes on this whole idea of how to go about orchestrating this whole thing. And he says, I believe he's writing to his wife here also. He says, "Rhodes is my man. I have just had 3 hours of talk with him. He is full of a far more gorgeous idea in connection with the paper than ever I have had. I cannot tell you this scheme because it is too secret, but it involves millions. He had no idea that it would cost £250,000 to start a paper, but he offered me down as a fee gift £20,000. To buy a share in the Pall Mall Gazette as a beginning. Next year, he would do more. He expects to own, before he dies, 4 or 5 million, of all which he will leave to carry out the scheme of which the paper is an integral part. He is giving £500,000 to make a railway to Matabeleland, and so has not available just at this moment the money necessary for starting the morning paper. His ideas are federation, expansion, and consolidation of the empire. He took to me, told me some things he has told no other man, save Lord Rothschild, and pressed me to take £20,000, not to have any return. To give no receipt, to simply take it and use it to give me a freer hand on the Pall Mall Gazette. How good God is to me. Remember, all the above about R is very private."
Huh.
Rothschild. He was getting extra funding from the Rothschilds to get enough money to take over this Gazette.
So Rhodes was receiving money from Rothschild, and then he was passing on some of it to Steed?
Steed was taking all the money, yeah, from Rhodes and Rothschild.
Oh, Steed was getting funding from both Rothschild and
yeah.
Rhodes?
Yeah.
So Rhodes wasn't getting funding from Rothschild?
Well, it was for the same project. Yeah. So yeah, that was after their first acquaintance, and now this one, from later on, gives a little bit of an idea of a discussion on how this whole thing was going to work. So this is a quote from a discussion with Rhodes. So Steed says, "We also discussed together various projects for propaganda, the formation of libraries, the creation of lectureships, the dispatch of emissaries on missions of propaganda throughout the empire, and the steps to be taken to pave the way for the foundation and the acquisition of a newspaper which was to be devoted to the service of the cause." So you get the sense of what they're doing here as one of the key elements to the expansion of an empire being needing to take on the media to control the information, ideas, and thus the minds of the population at large, shape social thought. So, so just a last, give you a last quote from Steeds, because he was a real important figure in the sense that for this whole propaganda mission. And also, he was the recruiter of someone we'll discuss next called Lord Milner, who is the actual official founder of the secret society, who actually took on the project and was, in a sense, introduced to the whole mission by Steed. So just to give you a last sense of this guy, he wrote a book on Rhodes' wills at one point, and he says, "Mr. Rhodes was more than the founder of a dynasty. He aspired to be the creator of one of those vast semi-religious quasi-political associations, which, like the Society of Jesus, the Jesuits, have played so large a part in the history of the world. To be more strictly accurate, he wishes to found an order as the instrument of the will of the dynasty. And while he lives, he dreamed of being both its Caesar and its Loyola." Then 60 pages later, he says, "The question that now arises is whether in the English-speaking world there are to be found men of faith adequate to furnish forth materials of the society of which Mr. Rhodes dreamed." So that was one of the tools that they used, this whole media propaganda sector that Steed was in charge of. And the other side was this whole question of a scholarship and how you would go about actually now taking on the education of the young people. So the Oxford University and the entire fund, which a large part of it was created by the wealth of the diamonds looting of Africa. in his company, De Beers. So that the fund would then be used for the creation of a secret society and the creation of a university oriented around developing the individuals that would then continue to carry out the mission. And so the whole Rhodes Trust was donated to the Oxford University to develop Rhodes Scholars. Yeah. Which Bob Ray is a Rhodes Scholar. Right?
Yeah, he's one of the guys that ran for the Liberal leadership. He's an NDP, ex-NDPer of Ontario. You know, he's anything but a socialist. But he's involved in many high-level oligarchic networks.
Yeah. So, something like £6 million was donated to the Oxford University. So, and this became later on a scholarship that would provide training for students all over the world that would get invited to come and get educated there. And a lot of the times, the scholarship would be subsidized by the trust if they found that the person was necessary. You develop agents, right? Like Kissinger, wasn't he nominally born in the United States, but yet he is a Rhodes Scholar British agent. And he actually openly admitted this in one of the RIIA conferences, saying that he was more open and honest to the entire British apparatus during the whole Nixon, the whole Nixon scheme and the whole thing around the Vietnam War, that he was actually serving the interests of the British over the Americans when he was like, was he both national? He was what was his position at the time?
Security advisor and secretary of state.
At the same time, you've never seen that. Like, I think he was the first person to ever be both of those very powerful, very influential positions. So, and he was trained, at Oxford University. So that was the idea of the university. And now, just as what's interesting, I thought, was the last two wills that I mentioned earlier that don't mention anything at all about anything that would coincide with everything else that Rhodes stood for previous to his second and last will. He doesn't mention a thing about the secret society at all. And this is near the time of Alfred Milner's involvement in the whole thing, who actually is, just to give you a background, he was the director of Rio Tinto's Inc., one of the major mineral corporations, raw materials cartel in South Africa. But he was quickly brought in to become a new trustee on the Rhodes Trust and of the Rhodes fortune to carry out the mission. And so he actually also went to Oxford originally and was also apparently inspired by the works of the same John Ruskin. So these ideas were already, I guess it wasn't too hard to convince him. But he was connected to Rhodes through Steed. And so he has a reputation of being the official founder of the Roundtable movement, which, interestingly enough, as soon as it started to get known, changed its name. So actually, I'll read you, I think it's from his autobiography, Milner, the founder that carried out the mission. So he says, or wait a minute, this is from, no, it's not his biography. He wrote a piece called Credo in 1890s. And it says a bit about himself. I'm a nationalist, not a cosmopolitan. A nationalist is not a man who necessarily thinks his nation better than others, or is willing to learn from others. He does not think his duty is to his nation and its development. He believes that this is the law of human progress, that the competition between nations, each seeking its maximum development, is the divine order of the world, the law of life and progress. I am British, indeed primarily an English nationalist. If I am also an imperialist, it is because the destiny of the English race has been to strike fresh roots in distant parts. My patriotism knows no geographical, but only racial limits. I am an imperialist and not a little Englander, because I am a British race patriot. It is not the soil of England, dear as it is to me, which is essential to arouse my patriotism, but the speech, the tradition, the spiritual heritage, the principles, the aspiration of the British race. The wider patriotism is no mere exalted sentiment. It is a practical necessity. England, nay more, Great Britain, nay more, the United Kingdom is no longer a power in the world which it once was. But the British dominions as a whole are not only self-supporting. They are more nearly self-sufficient than any other political entity, if they can be kept an entity. This brings us to our first great principle. Follow the race. The British state must follow the race, must comprehend it wherever it settles, in appreciable members as an independent community. If the swarms constantly being thrown off by the parent hive are lost to the state is irreparably weakened. We cannot afford to part with so much of our best blood. We have already parted with much of it to form the millions of another separate but unfortunately friendly state. We cannot suffer a repetition of the process.
The state he's talking about is the U.S.?
No, he's talking about the British dominions or the lands that they controlled at the time.
The friendly state that separated, they lost millions of people.
Yeah. So I mean, the idea is that you don't want that to happen. You know, so you want to actually find a way to ensure that increases the use of the dominions. The Dominion of Canada is a good example. So he became the administrator of the Rhodes Trust and established the society with a group of people he called the Kindergarten. They were new at this. We wouldn't call them kindergartens today. But, so, yeah, these guys were pretty well the circles that initiated, this movement. And, there's this character that comes out of this, Lionel Curtis, who's a very important, personage for Canada as well. And he was actually the one that was strengthening this whole idea of the Commonwealth. He's the one that was calling for it pretty heavily initially. and it then actually got established under his call for that. So I'll just let you know about Curtis. I'm actually planning to continue this research into this guy here, because it's pretty interesting for what they've been doing here in Canada and how they went about establishing their grip over the Commonwealth countries. But so the following quotations are taken from the it's called The Problem of the Commonwealth, and it was drawn up by the Roundtable Group. And published by Curtis, published under Curtis's name in 1916. And he says, in this world commonwealth, the world government, the function of government is reserved to the European minority for the unanswerable reason that, for the present, this portion of its citizens is alone capable of the task. Civilized states are obliged to assume control of backward communities to protect them from exploitation by private adventurers from Europe. The Commonwealth cannot, like despotism, rest content with establishing order within and between the communities it includes. It must, by its nature, prepare these communities first to maintain order within themselves. The rule of law must be rooted in the habit and wills of the people themselves. The people of India and Egypt, no less than those of the British Isles and Dominions, must be gradually schooled to the management of their national affairs. The task of preparing for freedom the races which cannot as yet govern themselves is the supreme duty of those races who can. It is the spiritual end for which the Commonwealth exists, and material order is nothing except a means to it. So that's enough to give you guys kind of a conception of what was going on at the time of the orchestration, you could say, of what we're actually seeing today. But and then when you think of, well, you know, why were these guys so enraged, in a sense, and destined to do this? Why then? So, I mean, what else was happening in the world at that time that, in a sense, in the eyes of an imperialist, made it necessary to do this? Do you guys get a sense of the late 1800s a little bit?
The British were going down?
Yeah, that's one thing. The British economy was collapsing. It was falling from being one of the world power economically. Right, and they were falling behind in every aspect. And yet other nations that were taking on the lead. Anything else, Sam?
The way Cecil Rhodes keeps talking about the necessity of getting back the United States of America, this is coming right after the British actually tried to break up the United States by backing the Confederates, right, the slave section of the U.S., and they lost. And they, I think that was the last third time that they made a war against the United States. And I think what he was mapping out there that you showed very clearly is we're going to have to try another means to capture the United States because we can't do it militarily.
Yeah.
And that, and this whole network, and some of the things that Val showed, some of these companies, like the mining interests and the banks, existed at the time that the British Empire tried to wreck the United States with the Civil War and split it in half. And they still exist today, and they're gobbling up, you know, parts, key parts of the U.S. and Canadian, North American economy, including Mexico. So, yeah, I think you made something really, I think, very crystal clear that once a military option was denied to them, they've tried this infiltration thing, and that's what we're looking at.
Yeah. Yeah, sure. I mean, like, I could have read a lot of things, because everything was really brutal. But I wanted to, you know, and I was trying to pick what can I use to convey this, and at some point I ended up with way too many really good quotes. So, but there's one of them that I don't have but on me, but where he's talking about, you hear a real resentment towards these pigs that are fighting against us and that are actually leading the rest of the world to take on their example. Yeah. So does anyone remember, I think everyone remembers 1776, but does anyone remember 1876? Yeah. The centennial celebration. 100 years after the American Revolution, nations from around the world gathered in Philadelphia to, like, leaders of nations to take on, to learn about the American system and to bring home the principles of the American system. Right? Because they were, it was a celebration for being the nation that, the most prosperous nation ever to exist on the planet.
Didn't France also give him a Statue of Liberty? Same year? Was it 1876 or 1776?
I don't know. I don't know what years it was in.
Si vous avez fait une autre 2 heures, ça va être.
Yeah, and I mean, this was something that was actually being adopted by nations around the world that had come to the United States and were taking home the principles. And so you saw Germany, Russia, Japan, France, all these countries, Italy, taking on these ideas, right? That are, you can read the Declaration of Independence for the best conception of the idea within the American system, right? How are you going to build a nation in the interest of the general welfare of all the people, which can guarantee, in a sense, that the future is going to be better for those that come after you? And that idea was starting to develop nations internationally. And the British Empire, which refused to adopt these principles, was collapsing and getting very pissed off. And this is, there you have a scheme that was developed out of this resentment towards the loss of of its the depletion of its empire, right? To create the scheme, as he himself says it, for a new type of maintaining the empire. Now, if it's not called British Empire because people are just too used to that and they don't like the term, fine, we'll change it, right? We call it globalization, or whatever you want to call it. All right, so that's the idea, and I just want to give you a sense quickly of what Lynn is saying here. It's pretty interesting about the American system. In such a society, with our Leibnizian 1776 Declaration of Independence and the preamble of our 1789 Federal Constitution, define this republic of ours to be, there can be no superior social classes, nor any institution by means of which any form of usury, financier usury or slavery, is allowed as means by which one group or persons can subjugate or otherwise loot one another, or loot another. Each newborn personality must be cultivated to the utmost degree possible in the development of those powers of cognition which define each as made in the image of God. Each must be afforded to the degree possible the opportunities of useful employment which are consistent with such developed cognitive powers. Each household and community within society must be afforded the opportunity which are consistent with these other requirements. Not only must we desire this naturally lawful state of affairs as our nation itself, we cannot be happy unless we are working to ensure the same rights for all humanity, for all nations. So that's the idea within the American system. And to let you know where this is going, just to wrap it up, now, in 1920, the Roundtable Group changed its name to the Royal Institute for International Affairs. So, what we're seeing here is as an off branch of that is the Canadian Institute for International Affairs. And there was a conference, because what these guys are really, like I mentioned this actually, they're a policy forum. And just to give you a sense, we actually have a transcript, not a transcript, but a write-up of one of the conferences given in 1995 by the RIIA. And it's written by an Australian, Catherine West. It's called Britain in the World. And certain opening statements were made by this sir. Whatever. That's all you need to know. And so just to give you a sense of what these guys are still today actively engaged in. Okay, so yeah, his name was Sir Lawrence, and he was one of the he made some of the opening remarks in regards to the still very present power of this faction today, even over and above the powers that lie in Her Majesty the Queen. So he says, we see more clearly every day that the foreign relations of Great Britain are only partly, perhaps not even primarily, in the hands of Her Majesty's government. Many of the people in the body of this hall have great influence over British foreign relations. So that's to give you a sense of how these guys, their understanding of who's actually even controlling the whole British Empire. And so later, another speaker at the same conference, this guy's name is Dr. John Ashworth, and he says, "I am afraid the British are getting more assertive because the 30 or 40 years of political program which followed 1945, in which the British establishment, the political elite, set themselves the task of orderly management of decline, has ended. We have had enough of that." Right, and if you think of all the degeneration that occurred after 1945, this guy is openly stating that the British set themselves the task of this type of digression within the culture of the United States that was inspiring sovereign nation state republics internationally. So... I don't want to depress anybody. So it's good to engage in a discussion that's what we are doing this weekend anyways. But to get a sense of that what we're doing, what we're building here is a real conspiracy against this, right, of how we actually go about stopping this process of exactly these intentions and the effects of these intentions that we see in these cartels and things like that. But it's good to reflect on what types of struggles like this, perhaps, have occurred in past history to get a sense of what type of character is necessary to make it through something like this now. Right, and you can think, we mentioned Benjamin Franklin, right? Jeanne d'Arc is another one, right? Martin Luther King. All these people can be a class on their own, because they're so inspiring. But to think of what type of, for example, sacrifices needed to be made, that these people knew they had to make, not for themselves, for the future of mankind. They're different for everyone. For Martin Luther King, it was his life. Right? So that's the type of thing that we can look at for the inspiration to do this, right? And a lot of this actually comes from an initial intention, an actual intention to fight and do the right thing, simply because it's the right thing to do, right? But that in and of itself comes from a deeper compassion, in a sense, for humanity and for mankind. So, I'd like to invite my friends up here for a minute, so we can take a minute. I did that because once you realize that there is something truly beautiful about being human, then you know that there is definitely something about humanity that's worth fighting for. So I'm gonna